to another edition of our Outside View podcast. Today, I am excited to talk to somebody I haven't talked to for a while, even though I see him on Facebook all the time, Joshua Sutton, who was a co-anchor with me on Blooming Out years ago, and also his partner, Jeremy, who I haven't actually met yet, but I guess I'll find out a lot about him today. So welcome to our Outside View, guys.
Thank you. It's nice to hear from you again.
Yeah, it is nice to talk again. How are you doing?
I am doing well. It's been a few years, I think, since we've ever talked together in any format like this. In fact, we talked about doing a podcast real fast and all the equipment we would need, and here we are on my phone, at least. So
I know. Isn't it amazing, the technology? Now, this system, when you get it to go through and actually make a call, it works. It's so easy. It's amazing.
It's fascinating. Well, I mean, I'm doing well. I think, so let's see, last we talked, we were in Bloomington. And then, of course, since then, I lived in Indy. And then I've lived in Columbus, Ohio for about 3 years. And recently, I just moved to Atlanta to be here with my now fiance, Jeremy. So,
oh, well, congratulations.
Thank you.
That's cool. That's really cool. You look so happy. And given some of the things that we have gone through here in Bloomington and Josh went through when he was younger, I'm really happy to see him so happy. So
it is amazing what happens with time, and to kind of reflect, especially today, on some of those things that we did experience. Because you have known me. When did we meet? We met...
I don't know when you first came to IU. So what were you, like a junior or a sophomore? Or?
Well, let's see. I went to Indiana State freshman year in Terre Haute, and that was in the fall of 2006. So I think I joined IU in the fall of 2007, and then I would have met you, I think, in 2008, that winter when I took over the out presidency. So
yeah, that's a long time ago. It really is. It's like 11 years. That's a whole decade. Wow.
That really is. I can't believe it.
I know. Well, yeah, you were an amazing president of out. You were a president, what, for 3 years? They kept reelecting you?
Yes, it was 3 years. And it was really an honor to be president of that organization and try to keep it going in those kind of final years that we had it. So,
well, you know, I was talking to Michael Reese the other day. We did a podcast too, and you know, he was a former co-anchor as well. And yeah. It's amazing how time goes by and how things change. And I was reflecting with him and now with you about that. Of all the anchors and co-anchors of the show, I'm the only one still in Bloomington. Everybody else left. They were smarter than me.
I have sung praises about you and Carol to Jeremy, because I, you know, now we put it in perspective, 10 years is a long time. And I am a completely, as I'm sure you are, a different person than, you know, you are every 10 years prior, but it's crazy to think that you were so adamant about getting out of Bloomington.
I know. Well,
that it rubbed off on everybody else.
I think so. I really think so. I think it's Indiana more than just Bloomington, because Bloomington, unfortunately, in some ways, it's an easy place to live. It makes it easy. You know, everyday, daily life, just coming and going is very easy. But the politics here, of course, and a lot of the attitudes are, they're just depressing, really, as you probably remember quite well. You know, and we moved from the country into Bloomington because country life, well, we're in our 70s now. Right. And we it got to be a little too much. I mean, we have a half an acre here where we are now, and that's enough for the dog and for a little bit of yard work and things like that. It got to be too much. And besides, the temperament in the last few years, and of course, once number 45 was elected, it became scarier. Yes. Out in the country. It really did. Nobody menaced us. We had fairly decent neighbors. At least we had a couple that were really nice. But it just began to feel more and more uncomfortable.
Well, you know, sorry.
Go ahead.
I was going to say that here in Georgia, leading up even to the election, when you leave the blue bubble of Atlanta on the blue-red map, and because I had a mountain place we would go to, and you would see these signs like billboards for sporting goods companies with guns saying a revolution is coming.
Yes.
And there was a real primal kind of threat in this country going on that I think people didn't realize, and that obviously Trump tapped into it, and it got him where he is, and now he's using that strength, and now they're very empowered.
You know, it kind of, well, I grew up in large cities, metropolitan areas, New York City and Kansas City, and I lived in D.C. and I lived in Philadelphia. And when I came here, I didn't realize, I moved out in the country because I wanted to have a little farm. I always wanted a mini farm. And what I realized is there were people out here that were still fighting the Civil War.
Oh, yeah.
And they were armed. Well, they do. They have underground bunkers and everything, because you never know when the government's going to come and get you. And
right.
I thought, this really exists. Well, it really exists. I just never was aware of it. And I think that's what we're seeing now, is the emergence of all those people. They feel empowered.
You're right. And, you know, Josh and I now live literally on the site of the battle for Atlanta. And when Sherman marched to the sea, he took off on the railroad tracks that are parallel to the street outside our house here. So I had known about these kind of conflicts and I'd seen things, but not to the degree that I see here. You know, the folks that don't live in the city, they come into the city and there's just a tension.
Right. Exactly.
That's greater than ever, unfortunately.
Well, I think I noticed on Facebook that you're originally from Pikeville, Kentucky. Is that right?
Well, I spent my formative years there. I was born in Detroit and lived in the suburbs until I was 8. And then my parents were both from the Pikeville area, and moved us back there. So I spent my high school and college years there. I went to the University of Pikeville for undergrad, and then I studied psychology at Marshall in West Virginia, and practiced there for 4 years before moving to Atlanta in 2000.
So you do know a lot about, you have a frame of reference for the South, kind of the Southern attitude.
Oh, yes. And then, you know,
I learned a lot from him.
I'll bet you have.
See, in West Virginia, when I moved in 2000, it was right after or right around the election. And that was, of course, Gore Bush. And so what came up then, we're talking about West Virginia in particular, because West Virginia went for Jimmy Carter the second time, went for Dukakis. I mean, it was a very, very blue state. And it flipped in 2000, and it was known that it was revealed then as the most homogenous state, meaning the most white, philosophy state. And I got that, but yet there were still problems. I remember, excuse me, when I was a psychologist in Southern West Virginia, in one of the offices I worked out of, I had to call Child Protective Services because a mother wanted me to fix her daughter because she wanted to go out with an African-American boy at their high school, like the one of two families at the high school. And the girl tells me that, you know, yeah, my eye is black because my mama hit me because I wanted to date this gentleman. So, and then when, you know, I was a mandated deporter by state law, not that I wouldn't have called authorities anyway, but you know, I had explained to someone, you can't abuse your child because she wants to, you know, she likes somebody you don't approve of. You know, you can't hit her.
Sure. Exactly.
So, yeah. So I wound up.
Children are not property.
No. And I wound up having to park my car away from the building when I went to that office again, because there were threats against my life because I took that stance and called the Child Protective Services. So it was, and you know, the things they would call me when they would call, I mean, they would literally say, I won't say the word, but they'd say, is the N-word lover there today? Tell him we're looking for him. Tell him we're looking for him. I'm just trying to help these people. So.
Well, you know, I came here when I came here actually to live, I guess you could say. I had, my house was burned down by the Klan, and I found out that, and oh, it's because I had a big house. I was renting a house, and I had a couple friends of mine, and they were a black and white couple, and they rented upstairs from me, and the Klan didn't like that very much.
Wow.
They burned the house down. We all got out. We were all okay. Jesus partly because we were young and could really run. But it made me realize, not, this wasn't in Bloomington. But
where was
it, made
this?
Me, huh?
Where was that?
Franklin. Where Franklin College is. That's how I ended up in Indiana. Was I went to Franklin College after, and then I went to Kansas University for graduate work. But Franklin, I found out that the police department, the fire department, all these were very Klan connected, and it just was terrifying to me, absolutely terrifying. And I realized, you know, then too, that those kinds of people exist too. But yeah. I don't know.
Wow.
I don't. That's why people say, you know, Bloomington is such a great place to live in Indiana because it's safer than that. Well, it is, but the outlying areas around here, just right outside the city, are not very friendly. And well, in fact, even some of the people in the city. But I guess if you kind of turn a blind eye to all that, it's kind of a comfortable place to live. But we are talking about moving again now.
Right. It's an interesting segue kind of into the, you know, I wouldn't say I've traveled a ton, but going to Bloomington, then Indy, and then I, you know, Columbus, Ohio.
Exactly.
A wonderful time, but they all share this common theme that we've been fighting and talking about all these years. It's the metro area and then the outliers. I got to know Columbus, Ohio pretty well through my line of work. I worked in a lot of the suburbs and neighborhoods. In fact, I knew more about the rural areas of Columbus than I did downtown. But it's like the further, we've talked about that bubble, further north, south, east, or west I got from the city, the signs for 45 and his running mate got denser and more thick. And, you know, it just, but Columbus was so blue and it's like, it wasn't that far away from the city. And the same thing for you, you're not that far from Bloomington. So like that protection is very small, and these people are emboldened right now in the outside.
Exactly. That's very true. Well, an interesting thing about Columbus is my grandfather was, my dad and my grandfather were from the region area of northern Indiana, right around Chicago. And my grandfather was part of the Underground Railroad. And he was very much, he was a union organizer way back in the 20s. And he moved to Columbus, Ohio from Indiana. He left Indiana because Columbus was a much safer, more comfortable place to be. So the whole time I knew him, he lived in Columbus. So it's kind of interesting the way the red and the blue states and the cities and the politics have changed over the years.
Yes.
But look, Columbus is a university city too. So
absolutely.
Well, Josh, what do you think about when you think back about your experiences without? How did that, I mean, well, in terms of how it's made you look at the queer community now, mm-hmm. and the fact that I noticed you have a flyer business now, you're doing graphics and things like that, like you did somewhat when you were here.
Yes. So I have to put time frames on things just to kind of put it into perspective. So I got to IU around 2000, so what did I say, the fall of 2007. I transferred from Indiana State, came to IU as a sophomore. So I joined out at that call out meeting in the fall of 2007. And prior to that, I had, when living in Terre Haute, you know, about 3 years before that, being a junior in high school, kind of put me in touch with my peers, a young queer community, because we had that kind of an underage venue to go to. And kind of where I got introduced to drag, and it was all unscripted. So going into the out presidency, I kind of had a touch of kind of the issues that faced my peers, because myself, I was kind of having an easy time coming out as a gay man. So the perception of what I dealt with and all the conversations we had, I think, have only grown from what were once seeds of change into these bigger conversations. So I think that time and out has prepared me today to understand the conversations that have matured, that I feel like started when you and I were first starting to meet, that kind of change in terms of the, just what you said, you addressed it as the queer community, how we address ourselves, gender identity issues, switching the L and the G so that the L has prominence, and, you know, all the flack I got for being a gay white man and being called unfair when that was furthest from the truth. So I feel like I started to experience the things that have finally broken the shadows and become mainstream issues because I was the president of an organization about 10 years ago when this stuff was starting to come out.
Well, I'm sure you remember that out no longer exists.
Yes.
And I think out was a really, really significant, important organization for queer youth, whatever. Yeah. And I do think it's missed on campus. I mean, students that I've talked to don't even know it ever existed. And everything goes through the, which is now called the LGBTQ plus culture center.
Okay.
Everything goes through that now. Well, at least they changed the name.
Yeah.
More, you know, comprehensive and more inclusive. But
that's great.
I don't really notice. I mean, I'm on their mailing list. I'm on mailing list for several organizations still at IU, and I don't see a lot going on. I do know that Bloomington Pride has grown.
Well, that was kind of the issue we had when OUT was in its final chapters. Was the issue of student power versus administrative power, and yeah, the LGBT Q plus house now, as it's called, was, you know, born, as I'm sure you've talked about, born out of the OUT organization, out of a student need. And it was actually, you know, revolutionary at the time because it was a recognition from a college administration that,
yes,
LGBT individuals, and that's great. So we've got that recognition, that mainstream light now in the professional and the college sense. But what it's done is that power has been taken away from the student body, I think. And we were seeing the start of that. In a sense that it's not needed anymore. And maybe for a few years there wasn't, with, again, the acceptance and mainstream of LGBT issues and being more forefront in conversation. But now that we're there, it's almost like the adults are playing and the kids aren't getting a chance to, you know, have their own voice again, which is almost a backward step.
I would agree with you. I know that there were certain people, like the vice chancellor, and when Herman Wells died, there were some big changes in the administration at the university. And I thought some of it, you know, when people say, well, when you get old, you can't always live in the past. Well, some things in the past were a good thing, and they contributed to the present and the future.
Right.
And I think OUT existed for, like, from the 70s to the, when was that, like, 2000 or something.
Well, and that's a great point, because it was born out of the need as the gay and lesbian switchboard, if you recall.
Exactly. Yes. Yeah. I still have all that documentation, actually.
Oh, wow. That's fantastic. I actually came across some old documents in my recent move I'll have to share with you. But yeah, you know, it's everything that was born and created out of a need. And sometimes they get washed up in all the change and completely eliminated. But I still feel there's a need there.
Oh, I do too. Definitely. Definitely. I know our granddaughter and her friends, there's a need. There's a need in Bloomington for community members as well. I mean, the Pride organization, they have the Pride Film Festival, and then they have a Pride event in fall, so it can include the students.
Yeah.
And actually, that's grown. They've done a pretty good job with that. It's grown, and it's pretty, you know, it's pretty well accepted in the town, in the city, town of Bloomington, whatever. Yeah. And, but I still think there's a need for that one-on-one advisory, mentorship kind of leadership.
Yes.
And yes, coming from the students themselves, because obviously, as you know, you were a leader, and the students that led out were leaders. They came there with that kind of personality, and they helped so many other students.
That was a beautiful thing. We had great leadership, and we didn't always agree, but that was the good part about it, because we grew from it, and it brought issues to my attention I was blind to, and vice versa.
If I could jump in, you
sure.
You brought up Pride movements in more rural communities, and in 1997, I was one of six people who founded the Pride West Virginia Committee, and we had the first Pride parade in West Virginia that year, and then expanded considerably over the years, and they continue with events even this past year, so it's going on for 20 plus years now. And I think about the need for Pride in rural communities particularly, and my hometown, as I call it, Pikeville, Kentucky, recently this past year had their first gay Pride event in the park where they celebrate Hibbly Days every April, which is a big bluegrass. So
yeah.
Times are changing. And
Josh probably told you about Spencer Pride too. I mean, Carol and I helped found Spencer Pride, which Spencer is a town of about 2,500 people.
Oh, wow. That's awesome.
And it takes about 20 minutes to get there from Bloomington. It's not very far. And it has grown exponentially. It's amazing. The job that they've done, they're going to have a conference there. The two guys that run it now are young. They have lots of energy. And they bought a building in Spencer, and they have a community center now.
Oh, wow.
They have events there, and they're going to have a conference there. So I have to give them a lot of credit and recognition for what they've done, because Owen County, which is where Spencer is, and Spencer's the county seat, people need that. Mm-hmm. Like you're saying, they need it in the rural communities and the small towns.
Yes, and I remember – six people put on an event that, 600 people came to the first time. We were delighted to have 600 people come out in daylight and march down to the state capitol on a Sunday afternoon in June in 1997. So I remember being sheerly exhausted. Like, I discovered a new dimension of exhaustion I didn't know was possible, really, at the end of it. And just really thinking, was this, what was all this for? And getting this call from, somebody I didn't know that had found my name in some of the literature, who just wanted to thank me and said that it had, he was unsure of his gender, but he went by, male pronouns, but he said, "I'm not sure that I'm going to wind up being a boy, but I saw things on TV, and it just, what you all were doing in Charleston, and it made me realize I'm not alone." And for every person that finds you and makes that phone call, or even online now, like sends an email, there are others, of course. And so, but even if it's just that one, I was like, that is why I did this. And I maintain that, people who are, I'll use the word privileged to live in larger metropolitan areas where pride has become more of a party, it's criticized as well. Is this really what we need now, that with marriage equality, and it's become just a big celebration. And do you need a party just for being LGBT? Well, it's not just a party. It's obviously the fact that we exist is a political statement, in terms of having pride events, but also there are those that attend that are inspired, and there are those that cannot attend, they're inspired by from a distance. And I think that saves lives.
It does. It absolutely does save lives. I know when Carol was, assistant administrator at the office on campus here. And I mean, the incidences, she was always very, very good at keeping confidentiality, but some of the cases and the situations and the students who, whose parents disown them and things like that. I mean, we need these organizations, and we need people out front. Mm-hmm. And I'm so happy. I mean, I dealt with my own prejudices toward me once I accepted the position of advisor out on campus. And then when I became, co-anchor of Blooming Out, and my picture's in the paper for the first queer radio station in Bloomington or Indiana, whatever, a lot of people turned their backs. All of a sudden,
out who your friends are, don't you?
Oh, absolutely, you do. Absolutely. Well, Josh, I wanted to talk to you just a little bit about what you're doing now. It looks like you're doing promotional work still, and
So I attended IU for interior design, and I completely morphed into some type of graphic promotional design technique, as I call it, that I learned. So, I spent more time on my presentation boards for a floor plan in a design studio than I did in terms of thought process of the design itself. So, everything was always pretty, just maybe didn't make sense. So,
it always looked good to me.
Thank you. I appreciate that. So that it all is relative out and then Miskey IU. Really what sparked what I'm doing today is kind of a freelance graphic design / branding service to specifically the drag queen industry. And when I say drag queen, generally drag queens, but it's not limited to just female impersonators. Any type of male or gender bending impersonator might seek help from me in terms of establishing a visual identity or designing promotional work for a special event, because social media is big now. And while a lot of these things don't go to print, they need things for Instagram and Facebook, and it's become a business without any brick and mortar foundation, and it's wonderful.
Well, I think I've always thought you were incredibly talented at design. I always have. And you, but you always had a vision too. I mean, you really grew Miss Gay IU.
You know,
it was such a success that I think that's one of the things that, you know, really doomed it as far as the university is concerned.
Well, I appreciate that. And that's the pageantry and the drag industry itself, as you know, was an integral part, especially like Vicky St. James. And
yeah, she's wonderful.
All those people. And I was fortunate enough to have a little bit of a connection coming into that, again, with my own personal background. But the very first thing that really sparked this design direction I've taken was the IU bus system offered us an advertising spot in the bus, and somebody had to design an ad. So I sat down and I figured out how to design an ad to fit this bus, whatever, with a little bit of knowledge that I had just acquired through my studies. And I managed to put a drag queen in the IU bus system, like, full and center for everybody to see. And I remember seeing that thinking, wow, I can do something with this one day. Hundreds of people get on this bus every day and see this event. And this,
it was amazing. This it really was amazing. It was so cool.
So, you know, Miss Gay IU really grew because of a vision and a want to do it. And the pageantry of hosting an event just gave everybody that creative outlet beyond, you know, what I was able to do with it.
Well, I also really firmly believe it served an educational purpose too.
It can I jump in? I'm sorry. I know you're talking, but I also promote female impersonation, and that's events and pageants, and that's how Josh and I actually met. But I think everywhere that there's an event, I agree there's an educational side of it, because people, when they enjoy themselves, they let their guard down and they open their minds, and then they walk away feeling more open to to the people that they've seen and what they represent in their mind. There's a, you know, a lot of the ads that Josh does now, a lot of venues are serve the straight community primarily, in like restaurant settings with drag. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And that's really, I think, done a lot to open people's minds and hearts as well.
Yeah.
I've always thought drag queens were incredibly, incredibly brave, strong people. I know they suffer with their own self-doubts and their own self-images and everything, but I mean, we wouldn't even have had the original gay movement if it hadn't been for drag queens.
Right.
And a lot of people aren't even aware of that. I used to try to do that on history on Blooming Out.
Oh, my goodness.
And I think they're absolutely amazing people. And the things that they're so brave, and they're also focused on education. I know here in Evansville, the queer group that's down there that Wally Painter's been organizing for years, and it does an amazing job. The drag queens are going to the library and reading to children, going into the schools, mm-hmm. and reading books.
Yeah,
and it's like, read with a drag queen or something like that. I don't know. And now they are getting opposition, though. The library, people have attacked the library and the library board and all this. Right. So I don't know how that's going to play out. But I think that's an important thing to bring children. I mean, and if children go into theater, you know, like somebody puts their child in dance or dance class or something. I mean, they're going to be exposed to all kinds of people. I think everybody should be. And then there wouldn't be all these bigotries.
Well, you know, there's an organization here in the Atlanta area that one of the services they provide is housing for runaway LGBT youth. And they are finding basically abandoned transgender youth as young as 11 years old now.
That's awful, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. But I also think, you know, if there's a kid in the story time who thinks, wow, I might not be the gender I think I am, or I might, you know, not everybody has to always adhere to what a society expects. If I feel different, it's okay to be different, that sort of message. I mean, there's lots to learn there, a lot.
That along with the message that, well, these people, they're not any different than I am. They're nice mm-hmm. people.
Yeah.
And they came and read books to us. You know, it eliminates that fear or that dread or that looking at somebody as being really odd or strange. It's, and of course, that's the opposite of what some people want to have happen. I realize that.
Right, that's a lot of the opposition. It's even unconscious, I think, but the folks, some folks are very resentful towards the drag community, even within the LGB community.
Oh, their yes. own
insecurities. But so much so that when we had that first Pride Parade, there was a gay article in the liberal press in West Virginia that criticized us for not including drag queens. There were drag queens in the parade, but they weren't prominently featured us enough, I suppose. And so that was the opposite of what we were trying to do. We weren't trying to exclude anybody. So in, to counterbalance that impression that we had included folks, I started with three other people, a pageant, Miss Pride of West Virginia pageant, and that has continued through the years. And that has, excuse me, gave us an opportunity to go to every city that could host a prelim, basically every place that had a gay bar, GLBT bar, and that wound up being like 11 different bars in the small state of West Virginia. But we would go to Bluefield and Beckley and Wheeling and Morgantown and Charleston Huntington, of course, Parkersburg. Definitely leaving somebody out. Anyway,
well, four... now see, I've never even heard of any of that. It's amazing because I've been through Wheeling, West Virginia, hundreds of times, driving back and forth to Pennsylvania and to New York, and I love the scenery. It's gorgeous.
Mm-hmm. It is.
But it always kind of seemed like a foreign place to me.
Well, you know, the bar that was there was like the first bar I went to in the early 90s, there was a light bulb that was turned on if it was open, and you knew where the door was to knock. If you didn't, you had no business being there. we saw lots of, you know, that time in that state's history, at least, there were lots of bars that used to be old homes that were turned into big, you know, bars, but also there's some pretty nice clubs. But at any rate, we had festival then right before the parade, we had a pageant, and then all the different cities came together to support their girl, and it had a pride presentation category, so it really forced people to really think about what pride meant to them and express it to the audience, and it was just really great thing, and that continues today as well. But that got me into pageantry and as a producer, promoter, and learning about transgender folks for the first time really face to face, and it has enriched my life. It's something I continue today. Josh and I do now together with the US of A at large system, and we met actually at a pageant in Tampa, Florida in 2011, the first time. So it just enriched my life. The most colorful, wonderful people, and people just don't know what they're missing. It's just an extraordinarily vibrant part of our culture that just gives me a lot of color to my life, for sure.
Well, it's absolutely nothing new either. I mean,
right.
It's been going on for centuries in all different countries. It's nothing new. It's just that people seem to be so shocked by anyone that dares to step out of that gender binary image or whatever. And then costuming. And of course, I grew up kind of being in theater, so that wasn't a shock to me, but it really wasn't. As a kid, it was just kind of normal. I had drag queen friends when I was a kid, and so I wish everybody could have that experience. But am I correct in thinking that you're an attorney, Jeremy?
I am.
You are. And what is your legal specialty?
I work in the area of healthcare law, but I don't do medical malpractice. I do litigation, anything dispute oriented, but that can be physician practices when they break up. Oftentimes that's not as smooth as they might like, but also those are kind of small cases compared to very large cases brought by whistleblowers claiming Medicaid fraud or Medicare fraud against a large hospital organization, for example, that it may just be a billing mistake, or there may be something there. We investigate and determine that. And if, you know, it's defensible, we defend it and go to litigation and appeals and all those things. So I am a litigator, but I also do about a third of my work is what we call compliance work. I work with large physician groups, helping them to make decisions so they don't get in trouble with the regs, because really there's no industry in the world more heavily regulated than healthcare in the United States. And
folks, oh, I know.
Folks can make a mistake and they think they're billing it right, and then they're not. And it really is just our bad. We did that wrong. There's no malintent. And it's my job to make that clear when that's the case. And when it's, and if it's not the case, then we usually refer to somebody else.
Well, I come from kind of a medical family. A lot of my family are doctors and nurses.
Oh, okay.
And not me. I went into psychology, but I wonder if you see changes since we've had this new administration in the last couple of years as compared to when Obama was president. I mean, healthcare to me is just, I think it's become a nightmare.
Well, you know, what's happened is, of course, that the marketplace has fewer payers in it now for Obamacare. So even though people may have coverage, it's harder for them to actually use it. You know, I'm in a state where Medicaid has not been expanded. So, and we have hospitals here that continue to close in rural areas at least a third of Georgia, and I'm probably saying the number wrong, it's probably more, people live more than 100 miles from an emergency room. So if they're having a terrible accident, they're really in bad shape. Or
yes,
if they need emergency medical care. And that is because these hospitals could not afford to stay open because they're giving away too much free care. And that was the point of the Affordable Care Act, was to fill in all those gaps. So if Medicaid had been expanded to capture those folks that were getting free care because they can't afford care, but they didn't qualify for Medicaid, we were supposed to get that, you know, that gap was the Medicaid expansion. So we didn't get that here. So that has really sent a lot of hospitals out of business. So in the healthcare industry, I can't say that things are any better. No, I do see an increased trend that continues of folks wanting to merge and combine into larger systems, larger and larger systems, so they can compete with one another and also for payment purposes.
I think one of the things that's discouraged me about all of this is that the insurance companies and pharmaceutical companies actually kind of telling doctors what they can do, how they can treat their patients.
Mm-hmm.
That I find that very distressing. I mean, doctors are the experts. They should know. And then they can't do this or that because of some regulation or because it's not covered by somebody's insurance policy or whatever. I've always been for universal health care. Now, how that actually is implemented, I realize there's a lot of steps to that.
That is something that's getting more attention now than ever. I think that there's a lot of confidence on the side of the Democrats, and they're willing to put forth bolder ideas like Medicare for All that President Obama didn't even try, really, because there was just no appetite for something that globally changing. But, who knows what could happen? I think that is probably, even though government doesn't run everything perfectly, the insurance companies follow Medicare, Medicaid regulations anyway, and what they pay, what they don't most of the time. I mean, at least as a guideline. So it would probably make more sense. It would put, a lot of people in the insurance industry would be very upset because I'm not sure they'd have a role anymore. Somebody, it's just, there's going to be a lot of resistance to that. Well, obviously, so.
I think so. Well, I think some of the resistance is people just don't understand how all of it works now, and then what it would take to change it, and the implications of. They always are afraid. So many people are afraid they're going to have to pay for somebody else. Well, they don't realize they're paying for somebody else anyway. All the people that go to the emergency room and don't have coverage. The rest of us pay for that.
Well, and we pay for somebody else when we're healthy and don't use our insurance for the year that somebody else does. And we pay premiums that are invested those premium investment proceeds are used to pay for somebody else's care. We are always paying for somebody else's care. And then when we're sick, we want somebody else to pay for our care. That's how the system works.
I know.
That's how insurance
exactly
works, Paul Ryan.
I'm sure he's going to listen to you. He stepped down. That's how.
Yeah, but he so famously was like, well, you can't make healthy people pay for unhealthy people's care. Well, that's the only way insurance works. You have to spread the risk.
That's right, exactly. I want to ask you a question just because you are a lawyer, and I know this may not be your area of expertise, but the courts ruled about that case, one of the many cases about that baker who wouldn't bake a cake for a gay couple, and they ruled in his favor. And I wonder the implications of that. I realize that was just one narrow case, but the implications of that on down the line of businesses having the right to deny services based on their religious beliefs.
Well, it isn't, the court was very clear that it was a narrow holding, and it's not very useful in terms of precedential value, right? In terms of applying it elsewhere. But at the same time, it's not like we can ignore it either. And I think it does send a message that, and we're going to have more of these cases, they're already working their way through, right? It's the ongoing tension we have between religion and equality. Religion has been pitted against equality for a very long time, superficially so, really. I never thought that, GLBT people couldn't be religious and religious people couldn't like LGBT people, but they've been pitted against each other.
Used politically.
Yeah, politically, for sure. And it really got, if you pay attention to the history, it got much worse when Reagan empowered the moral majority, as they called it, and the evangelicals and the ones that organized as a force. And when communism fell, I'm not alone on this theory, but nobody really believes me. But if you pay attention, when the Berlin Wall fell, it got much worse. The scrutiny against the LGBT people in this country got much worse because the religious folks and even the 700 Club and all those folks turned away from the evil empire of Russia and Soviet Union and much more onto what was going on in our own countries are blaming us for natural disasters and all that baloney.
It seems like those kind of people have to always blame somebody.
It's got
to
be a scapegoat.
For natural phenomena, even. I mean, yeah. You know. And I think I think some of them actually go step over the edge. They just go insane if you look at some of them after they get older.
They do. and you know, even though 45 picked the battle with transgender folks in the military, Judge needed a scapegoat, frankly, because he, you know, was having another bad day. And with no data, no reason, and no support, frankly, at the time, a lie about any study being conducted at the time. And that's another thing that we're struggling with in the legal system. I teach a course at Georgia State University College of Law on sexual identity and the law. And I used to, you know, we used to talk about military service that week was talking about a history of Don't Ask, Don't Tell. But now it's the history of Don't Ask, Don't Tell and the transgender legal fights. So the old fights are new again.
Well, yeah, they've started a fight in the military, actually doesn't even want to participate. I mean, they don't want to release the transgender soldiers and people that are serving.
That's the disruption. They're talking about unit cohesion, which is a made-up term, and about, you know, disruption of service. This thing they're doing is the disruption.
Yes. It's a distraction, right? Because actually nothing positive is being accomplished in this country right now at all.
No.
Nothing.
No. Nothing.
They're trying to turn us back into the 1950s. And believe me, I grew up in the 40s and 50s, and I remember what it was like in some respect. I was a kid, yes. Mm-hmm. But I remember the position of women. Uh-huh. I remember how people were treated, people of color. Uh-huh. I remember all that. And I don't want to go backward. And there's a whole lot of us that don't. I think it's absolutely insane to think that we should. And to turn back progress is just, I don't know. It kind of just, sometimes I'm just in awe of what people say, the things that they say and the rationalizations they come out with for discrimination.
Well, you know, it's not even turning back progress. It's demonizing and attacking progress as, you know, false science or, you know, against the American way or, you know,
it's a kind of a process of de-educating people, if that's such a word.
That makes sense, though.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I think you can de-educate somebody by educating them for sure. Like you know, do you remember there was a group we once talked to, and I don't remember their name, but we were there with their inception, and they wanted to use Blooming Out as a way to get to outreach, and it was that group that their purpose wasn't to sway or debate about political topics, but how to talk about them. Do you remember that group?
Vaguely.
Okay. Well, either way, I'm not sure their success now, but I had always thought the concept was fascinating because some of the issues at hand are so simple, but the media and the propaganda has made it so complex that people my age and younger don't even know how to start talking about some of the things because you can't even make sense of it to even debate it in the first place. It's just word vomit every day.
You mean like trying to decipher one of our president's speeches?
Sure. Yeah. Every tweet, every speech, every aspect of daily operation that comes out of the White House. And it was interesting that I was in D.C. With Jeremy a few weeks ago, and I had got to see the White House for the first time, and I was there with a now local friend, and he was just talking about how everything is just pretty much thinned out, and the interest has died down even around the Capitol, which means people just don't know how to talk about it and don't want to anymore, and it's terrible.
Well, and that I find that kind of alarming.
Absolutely.
I really do because, well, I think people feel like government is so, you know, in control and out of reach that they can't do anything about it. And I don't think that's true. I think this recent election does show that, you know, the populace as a whole can make changes.
Yes.
And we have to keep pushing our message forward. We have to keep educating children. I mean, I've been appalled at the support for these charter schools, which are all just a guise for evangelical religion. Almost all of them are. And pushing this narrow-minded, negative, ignorant philosophy.
Yeah.
And I'm kind of appalled at it, and I'm very appalled that we are taking money from public schools. And I'm opposed to private schools anyway. I always have been, because I think you need to be socialized in the whole construct of your society. And how can you make decisions if you've never been presented with any choices?
Very fair point.
And so I think children being brought up with just one kind of straight line answer for everything. You know, I remember asking a little child once, and it kind of struck me as odd at the time. And now when I reflect upon it, it's not uncommon at all. But I asked her where she got her big blue eyes. And she said, God gave them to me. And she was only like three. And I was thinking, that's kind of where the brainwashing begins. Is no, I was used to children who might say, well, my mom and dad, my mom has blue eyes. And, you know, something a little more scientific, even for a three-year-old. That's the science in me anyway.
Yeah, that's crazy. That's such a valid point and a view that I've never even taken time to think about. It's at such a young age, and it's almost that God-fearing aspect too. If you don't accept this, then you're damned any other way.
Right, exactly. Well, so you two are engaged now.
Yes.
And I suppose there's a wedding planned at some point.
Yeah, there will be, probably, yes. There is.
It will probably be in 2020, just because of, you know, those things take time, and we're, Josh moved here in July, and so we're loving, still, you know, nesting and...
Oh, sure.
I think this would be a good point to kind of recap everything together from 10 years to now, is that, you know, you never, when I met you, you were were you an advisor for, I know you were advisor to Al, but what was your administrative role at the university?
I think I was a program administrator and advisor in one of the communication programs at the time, I think.
Was it, weren't you in African Studies when we were?
I went to African Studies after I left the other job. And I was administrative assistant to the director there, program administrator.
That's right. So.
And I did do some advising, and I worked with outreach and things like that.
Which was wonderful, because you had, you know, I couldn't have had a better person to work with, because you were open-minded and, you know, you had a very strong cultural approach. And, you know, I always admired all your advice and everything we went through, because we went through a lot of, I don't know what the right word is, but red tape, as far as trying to be a student organization with academic support. You know, you took a lot of flack. And so I've never had a chance to say thank you. Thank you for all the support and advice you gave.
You're welcome.
You know, but it all led to, you know, the point that we're at today. You wanted to always have your own podcast. And so I'm so excited that you're doing that for yourself and uncensored. We don't have to worry about somebody dropping the F-bomb.
That's right.
On regulated FCC channels. you know, you were there kind of from my beginning of the drag industry, and which has led me to meeting this man that you can't see, but sitting in front of me. So it's a beautiful thing how it all works out. And I'm glad to see that you guys are doing so well.
Well, thank you. We are enjoying retirement. I have to say, I think Carol worked from the time she was 14 or something. And I worked off and on at different things.
That too.
Years, but I was at IU for 33, 34 years. I enjoy retirement. I enjoy getting up one day and saying, I don't want to do anything today and I don't have to. It's nice. but I also miss the students a lot. Yes. I miss the students, and I miss interacting. I do miss doing the radio show. We did that radio show for 11 years.
And that's one of those things. You started it, it's grown into something else, and it's, but you will never, nobody will ever be able to take that away from you, even in the time that you've invested, you know, it's all archived. And that's, you know, truly beautiful.
I don't know if it's all archived or not. I don't know if it's anywhere. It's all, I think mostly it's guys running it now, and guys running the station and guys running the show and everything. That's just not right because you need to hear from all sorts of people.
Yes. Oh, and that was your mission. And I think we did a pretty good job at doing that when we were there and, you know, and while you and Carol were there. And you guys gave so many students an opportunity, too, to, you know, get that technical aspect of running a show, too. And, you know, it's sad sometimes to see how, you know, in this talk of change and how great things have become, sometimes there are sacrifices. And unfortunately, people don't carry on the initial vision. And, you know, how, what do you do, you know?
Well, I have to say one thing about you as a leader is you were so all inclusive, and you really did want to get the women students involved. And
oh my gosh, did I not?
I know you did. And it was always kind of an effort for some reason to get lesbians or straight women involved with things. I never could quite figure out why, but it's kind of the atmosphere, I think, on that particular campus is it's very still very much a patriarchy.
Yes. Yes.
And kind of Bloomington is, too. I think that's one of the things that we have to resist all the time. And, you know, when you spend your time resisting, it takes energy away from accomplishment.
Absolutely. Isn't that the truth?
but we did manage, I think, to accomplish some things. And from a historical perspective, I think we, you know, we, a lot of us led the way in making things happen. I see results somewhat, and it's not all as comprehensive as I'd like to see it, but it is. But so what do you two have in your future? It seems like you're busy. I notice on Facebook, you're always traveling somewhere.
Well, blessed as it is. Jeremy, in all this talk, has been the national promoter of Miss Gay USA at Large, which is, quick drag knowledge, a national drag pageant, one of many platforms out there. Similar to the real pageant industry, America, USA, all that stuff. It's just the counterparts for female impersonators. And then the at-large portion means girls of plus size. So we've got the US of A system was started in the...
35 years ago
as Miss Gay USA. And then it advanced to Miss Gay US of A due to some legal reasons. And then there was a need for a plus size division because, you know, as you have in any industry, whether it's drag queens or racing, there's always somebody that says there needs to be another category. So in 1989, Miss Gay USA at Large was born, and that was for the female impersonators, again, of the plus size. And they got to compete at a national contest, and if they win, they get to travel the country and tour for a year and go and watch other hopeful queens get crowned to do it all again and go to another national contest. So Jeremy was able to take that over in 2011, and we are approaching 30 years of the pageant as a whole. So we're really celebrating that. And in this day and age of drag being mainstream and accepted, we're trying to keep pageantry, you know, which really brought competitive drag to the clubs and the underground scene very much alive. So that's where the traveling comes in. It's always about drag usually.
That sounds exciting. I really miss the drag shows. I mean, there's still a Miss Gay IU here, but it's very downsized, and I think they hold it in the dorm, and I don't know. I haven't gone to it at all. And the drag, we don't go out to bars much anymore. I mean, we're kind of past that. You reach a certain point. I mean, you guys are a long way away from that, but.
You're not out there doing the line dance anymore on Friday night.
Oh, are they? I miss the pageantry and yes. the comedy part of it. I miss the sense of humor. I really do miss it. But, you know, one of these days we may just come to Atlanta and visit you all.
Absolutely.
Please do.
Always welcome. We've got a lovely spare room, and it's a fabulous city. There's so much. I'm so thankful to be here and you know, you're talking about places to explore, and it's one of those places where it's got a lot of those same struggles that we've experienced in our own and other communities, but it's also got, for everything bad, there's a lot of good here. And it's and the weather's nice. I know how you hate the cold weather.
Oh yes. I'm looking at snow right now, and I have a feeling you're not.
No. it was a little brisk this morning at 38, but I will take that over whatever you have.
Yeah, I think it was 22 this morning.
Yeah, we win.
Yes,
you do.
What do you have planned?
Well, I do. I do like Atlanta. I've been to Atlanta several times, and I think it's a great city. And we are considering, in a year or so, we may move again, and finally move away from here. And we've been thinking about the Southwest, which I really love. Mm. And then we've also been thinking about Atlanta.
Yes.
So, but I'm sure we'll be in touch.
Yes.
And I want you to know, it's been great talking with you guys. It's been great, you know, reconnecting with you, Josh, and then meeting you, Jeremy. And
thank you.
It sounds like you guys have a really great life and great plans, and that's wonderful.
We're very happy. Thank you so much.
So good talking to you.
And yeah, we'll talk to you again soon, I hope.
Yes, absolutely. Please. Anytime.
Okay. You guys take care.
You too. Bye-bye.
Bye.